maintaining one's inner joy and celebrating life, even when you are under threat, even when you feel like the world is falling apart. It is absolutely essential for our own self-empowerment to cultivate joy. And to the extent that we are able to cultivate and manifest that joy, to that extent, we will be able to generate the justifiable anger that we're in control of, rather than the kind of anger that controls us, in order to effectively engage in resistance in whatever form resistance has to take under what and whatever circumstances call for that resistance.
The path keeps unfolding, and with it, the questions deepen, the longings sharpen, and our conversations and touching places that we cannot fully name, but we are fully called to jump into them. So this is the Free Radical Podcast, an arena, sacred space, hopefully crafted to engage together, where we don't just talk about truth, but we try to chase it, to leave it, sometimes to lose it, and to gain it back in a newly refined, ever-evolving, rediscovered way. So today I had the fortune, great gift, of engaging in conversation with Hari Kirtan Das. He's a practitioner, yoga teacher, writer, bhakti guide, who's, in my opinion, whose voice carries the weight of tradition, but the freshness of inquiry, discernment, and a deep concern with keeping the school, as I love to say it, relatable and relevant, not only for other people, but for us as well. So Hari Kirtan Das is a yoga and meditation teacher, spiritual mentor, online course creator, and the author of two books on yoga philosophy, Journey into the Bhagavad Gita and In Search of the Highest Truth, Adventures in Yoga Philosophy. He became a member of ISKCON in 1977 and has served in ISKCON off and on in a wide variety of roles since that time. He also has an 800-hour yoga teacher certification from the Jivan Mukti Yoga School and has been teaching yoga and meditation classes for the past 16 years. Hari Kirtan is on the faculty of numerous yoga teacher training programs, offers small group mentorships for yoga teachers, and is a frequent contributor to forums, magazines, and podcasts. His focus is on helping people navigate big questions about purpose, meaning, and how to stay sane in a world that often feels like it's spinning out of control. So our conversation spanned a wide variety of themes, but we concentrated a lot on the notion of activism, of bringing bhakti and spirituality back into the world, how a tradition unfolds in a certain political environment, how to engage with socio-political dynamics in a relevant way, in an ethical way, in a deep way, in a committed way. He has his beautiful concept of dharma rebellion. So what's the role of non-resistance, non-cooperation in the context of practicing spiritual life and dealing with reality and life and society? What's the role of anger properly honed and expressed? What's the role of joyfulness as a form of resistance? What's the role of grieving in this sacred equation? And so many other themes in between. Invited to the conversation and learning more about it. This is a Free Radical Podcast. So to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel inspired, nourished by the conversation, like it, share it, drop your thoughts to keep this dialogue for what it is, an ongoing engagement with ever-unfolding, deep, bright reality. So without further ado, dear friends, here is Hari Kirtan. Hare Kirtan, Prabhu. It's my honor to have you today in the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's my honor to be your guest on the Free Radical Podcast.
I'm thinking now about this line from our, not only Vaishnava tradition, but in India in general, Atithi Devo Bhavan, that an uninvited guest is to be treated as God himself. So I have a great invitation in my hands now. You are my guest. I'm invited to see the presence of the divine in you coming to me. And the day we are recording this is Guru Purnima in our tradition, the day of the Guru. No? So for me, Guru, of course, there are individuals representing that, but ultimately a proper Guru will invite us to see the Guru everywhere, right?
Even yes. In
an uninvited guest. You are uninvited guest. So if we are to see God in an uninvited guest, what to speak if you invite the guest to come to the table. So yeah, looking forward to how Krishna manifests through you in this conversation today.
Yes, well, likewise, it is my great good fortune to be able to spend this time with you. And yes, indeed, our tradition encourages us to see gurus everywhere we look. It's kind of like playing Where's Waldo? Where is my guru in this situation, in this person, in this instruction, in this obstacle, in this element of nature, everywhere? So
where is Waldo? That's a good one. I never thought about that. because Waldo is there. Even when you begin and you say, I'm not finding him, I'm not seeing him.
Right. But you know.
That tells you, you know he's there. Keeps
right.
Everything.
Mm-hmm. And of course, in our tradition, just the act of looking for Waldo or looking for Krishna, looking for our guru, that is in itself a transcendental activity. With Waldo, maybe not so much, but certainly when we go for a walk in the woods and instead of seeing a tree, we see Krishna and Krishna's energy. And when we look at, all of nature around us and we're constantly thinking, where is Krishna? Well, you know, that's practically speaking the pinnacle of our practice.
Exactly, as you say, the vision of the highest devotee is to see everything Krishna and Krishna's in everything. And I would say that's engraved in one of the main instructions in our school, which is Sri Chaitanya saying Trinada Pisunichi Natarura Pisaishnun. And again, you gave the example of the tree, and he's not seeing a tree, he's seeing a guru teaching him endurance and tolerance and forgiveness and so many qualities. And again, I'm not here proposing let's go back to look for where's Waldo, but I can see how that image can help us to relate to the idea of, I'm not seeing guru here, I'm not seeing the lesson, but I know it's there. So keep refining, keep honing the eye, no? Because at the end of the day, it's about learning how to see and learning how to find what we know. It's omnipresent, ultimately. I like to think, okay, guru, Krishna is the original guru, God is the original guru, and God is omnipresent. So if God is omnipresent and is the original guru, means the guru is everywhere.
Yeah, the guru is here somewhere, and sharpening our vision so that we recognize when the guru is present and instructing us. That's such an important part of our practice. Mm.
So Hare Kirtan Prabhu, I always like to ask my guests what brings them today to the conversation, apart from my official invitation for you to be here. So you are not imposing yourself here coming unexpectedly to this conversation. I've invited you officially just in case. But are there any... what brings you to the table? Not saying you come with fixed expectations that we will speak or go here or there, but what brings you to the table of this conversation today?
Well, for starters, just the fact that I have known about you, you have known a little bit about me, we've kind of traveled in similar circles and yet somehow or other never met. You were recently in Washington, D.C., and of course you came on a weekend when I was out of town, so I didn't get to come and hear your talks. And so I was just anxious to finally make a personal connection with you. And to, in this particular instance, the opportunity to have a conversation with you about issues and challenges in our devotional journey, you know, having read some of your writing, you are a very productive author. And so I'm having trouble keeping up, frankly, with everything that you've written. But, you know, having gotten a little bit of your indirect association, I can see that we are concerned with some of the same things about how we understand personalism or radical personalism, and particularly how the exercise or the engagement in the practice of radical personalism on a social level is important and neglected in our community, that we need more engagement with the world. And what I mean by that is more proactive broadcasting of the ideas of our philosophy into the marketplace of ideas to show people that there's a good reason why they should be reading Gaudiya Vaishnava literature and inquiring about what Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy has to say in a practical way, or in other words, how a worldview, which is something we have, translates into practical solutions to problems that people think are actual problems, as opposed to the many problems that our philosophy solves that most people don't even think of as problems in need of a solution.
Thank you. And yeah, of course, I'm hearing you, and I cannot but go back to my second book, Radical Personalism, what I personally feel also the need of. One of the main concerns for me writing the book is how to keep the essence of this tradition relevant and relatable, not only to a contemporary audience of people who are not members of the tradition, but to begin with, to ourselves, members of the tradition.
So yes.
How we feel the tradition is speaking to us and speaking to contemporary issues, social issues, things that are happening around us in the world that somehow or other, like it or not, as transcendental as we would like to see ourselves, affect us, and what our tradition has to say about that, and how what the tradition has to say should be said and think and applied in a particular unique way in the here and now. So yeah, I was listening to you and I kept going back and forth over and over again with those sections.
Yeah, it isn't just a matter of sharing our ideas with people outside of our tradition or outside of our movement, however you want to say it. It is for our own benefit. First of all, just so that we have a sense ourselves of how our philosophy translates into values, ethics, and eventually public policy. And the reason it's important on a collective level is because history shows us, and a little bit of observation confirms, that spiritual movements unfold in political environments. And those movements are not immune, however transcendental they may be, they are not immune to the political environments in which they unfold. And so it's, in my view, a responsibility of those who are caretakers and proponents of our particular spiritual movement to be aware of those impacts and be prepared to respond to those impacts in a truly constructive way that's consistent with our philosophy. Not just some practical, neutral, really not contributing anything new way, but it, rather actually understanding what really is our philosophy's response to the environment, the political environment in which we find ourselves.
I cannot but think about the word embodiment, that what you are proposing is one way of practicing an embodied tradition, not only in connection to not neglecting our physical, psychic, emotional vehicle, but acknowledging the environment that we are in this case, social, political one. And I really appreciate your point and how every time we choose to look at any tradition, even beyond ours, they all unfold in a particular political setting, and that influenced the way the movement unfolds. And because in part the movement unfolds in response to that particular environment, and not every time the political, social political environment is the same. So naturally the ongoing unfolding of a movement has to have a relevant updated response to the unique environment they are continuing to unfold. Because if you say, now the Gaudiya Vaishnav movement unfolded 500 years with Sri Chaitanya in Bengal in India, and he did this and that in response to the caste, and that's fine, great. But we are in a different planet and eon, so to say, especially considering how fast things unfold in the recent decades. So that's challenging in the sense that that forces us to keep up with that intense speed of unfolding and have relevant and relatable answers for any given scenario we are dealing with. So it's challenging, and I want to make that clear to the audience. Here we are not talking about some, hey, let's bring easy answers, and this is the definitive, ultimate, eternal conclusion, formula, how to do it forever here. No, no, it's an ongoing adjusting and questioning and answering and paying attention and adjusting again.
Yeah, especially right now, it's a matter of how fast can you renovate? You know, how quickly can you adjust? I think your point is really well taken. And that's come up recently for me in my community conversations. I have a free monthly community conversation where we come, we speak about the relationship between spiritual philosophy and social issues. And this problem of how things are happening so fast and how things have accelerated, especially very, very recently. You know, how do you account for that? You can't point, like you said, you can't point to, well, this is how it was done 500 years ago, or this is how it was done 5,000 years ago. We are not religious fundamentalists. We are not people who think everything is set in stone, even though we subscribe to the idea of sacred order, which we call Dharma, you know, a North Star that everything revolves around that does not change. Those are principles. And those universal principles are meant to be applied in order to determine how the variable details should be in order to respond according to those principles in a way that's relevant to a time, place, and a circumstance. And like you said, it's not going to be the same everywhere all the time. Even a few years ago, things were different. Now we have an adjustment to make in present circumstances and around the world. Spiritual movements have to unfold in different ways based on, you know, what kind of government is in charge and, you know, what will they allow? How liberal or how restrictive will a government be insofar as freedom of religion or spiritual expression or varieties of faith forms that can be publicly expressed? You know, those of us who require public spaces in order to execute the Yuga Dharma, well, for one thing, we have to make sure that there are public spaces, that everything does not become privatized so that there's no public property left for us to engage in Harinam. And then after that, we need to consider public displays of various faith forms. Those have to be protected in order for us to utilize that public space and engage in what we regard as the essential activity to change the atmosphere that Kali Yuga brings our way just by the progression of time. So something as simple as that, you know, the awareness of the need to protect public spaces and the awareness of the need to protect the first guarantee of freedom in the Bill of Rights, the United States addendum to the Constitution, which is freedom of religion and also freedom from religion, or the restriction on the government that they cannot adopt a particular form of faith as the official state religion. That should be a big deal for us.
Yeah, there are so many implications. As simple as that may sound to some, if you play out the implications, if each one of these ideas you are presenting, as you say, that should be a big deal for us. And I appreciated what you mentioned, going back for a minute to what you said a few minutes ago, Hare Kirtan Prabhu, about, okay, we have some dharma, we have some sacred order, we have some timeless, eternal truths, and there are principles, but the principle always plays out in specific ways, no? In specific contexts, specific time, place, circumstances. So for me, this is basically our metaphysics, achintya bheda abheda, right? Bheda abheda means non-different and different. More like unchanging, the timeless truth, the cosmic order, and specific and diverse according. I mean, bheda abheda can be applied in so many departments. I remember reading from one Vaishnava scholar, he will say, bheda abheda doesn't only mean, okay, God and his energies. Yes, but in one sense, there's nothing apart from God and his energies. So in that sense, everything is included in that cosmovision. Yes.
And the sum total of reality.
Yeah, exactly. So politics fall into that, social dynamics, human relationship, whatever, you name it, we can speak of that in some way or another in terms of unity in diversity. Right. So I appreciate your point in terms of honoring timeless truth, eternal unchanging principle, so to say, but also the unfolding of that and the application and expression of that in very specific, unique ways. And as you say, in connection to the, going back to the socio-political scenario, allowing people to express their faith in different ways, seeing that beyond that diversity, that there is an underlying principle. And even as you say, someone chooses not to be aligned with any spiritual religious tradition, acknowledging that agency in the individual as well, right? Because of course, if we play out the implications of not doing that, we'll get closer and closer to a totalitarian regime. And we've gone so many times there, and we continue to go so many times there. We human beings are a very particular species, I must say. I mean, I'm laughing not to cry at this point, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it's a paradox. And Srila Prabhupada actually speaks to this in one of his purports, that, you know, we rail against secularism you know, modernity and atheistic governments and such like that. But there is a purport where in speaking about Dharma as principles of religion, Prabhupada says it is the duty of the government to pay attention to the principles of religion, not and then he goes to great pains to say, this is not a religion that he's speaking about, but he's talking about principles of religion. The government has a duty to uphold them. And he specifically says that a secular government can recognize a wide variety of forms of faith. And it's just ironic or a paradox that in order to secure freedom of religion and therefore freedom for us to practice our tradition in private, in public, wherever, you actually require freedom to have no religion on the part of other people who have no particular inclination to practice a form of faith as we understand it in any kind of theistic way.
Yeah, because if that's not there, there's no choice whatsoever. I mean, if I don't have the choice of not being a Gaudiya Vaishnav, how much did I actually choose to be a Gaudiya Vaishnav?
Right. Yes. That freedom of choice has to be there for all of us.
Yeah. With all its risks and implications. But again, we want freedom as the foundation of love, which is a voluntary choice at the end of the day.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly we can find common ground with people who do not practice a form of faith insofar as ethics and values are concerned. And many people in conversations I have are quick to point out that people who subscribe to some form of faith will often, you know, I mean, history is just littered with examples of how, you know, religion
becomes justification. I know where you are going now, but please.
Yes, exactly. You know, people never commit atrocities more cheerfully and enthusiastically than when they have some religious motivation to do it. And this becomes a really good, perfectly reasonable reason for people to reject the idea of religion altogether. We think they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but certainly the history of religion doesn't really do itself any favors.
So far from what I'm listening from you, I'm of course from what I've listened before this conversation and read from you, Corey Kirtan, your work explores, and I will very much align with that, what we could call, how to engage with the world without losing our center, what we may call engaged Vaishnavism. Sometimes it's a term applied to Buddhism, engaged Buddhism. So we could speak about the form of engaged Vaishnavism, which in one sense for me is a redundancy, because real Vaishnavism should be engaged, right? To say disengaged Vaishnavism is an oxymoron for me.
I believe you are correct.
Yeah, okay. So, and in the context of that engagement, again, you are suggesting or inviting or reminding us that the essence of our and other traditions invites to respond to political realities. So, and I will try in between our conversation a little bit to play the devil's advocate, if you allow me to do so, because it's important, I think, to bring the arguments that sometimes may be in people's minds, even sometimes in our own mind, and trying to engage in conversation with them. So how do we balance this, like engagement with the world, engaging with socio-political dynamics as spiritualists without becoming partisan or without diluting our theological depth? Let's begin there.
Okay, that's a good question. And this comes up a lot, this idea that we cannot be engaged in partisan politics, which has an underlying assumption that we have to choose between conservative and liberal. And I think for us, this is a false choice. Because when we start to look at the psychology of people who gravitate toward liberalism and the psychology of people who gravitate towards conservatism and the values that they prioritize, we find that we dip into both camps. So we cannot really place ourselves in some linear way along that spectrum. And then we have an added consideration, which is something that we have in common with the 20th century philosophy of traditionalism, which I know that you have also been looking at recently, which is this idea of sacred order and the project of restoring it. Well, you know, I mean, if the Bhagavatam is about anything, it's about the restoration of sacred order as we understand it. So we actually have to kind of triangulate our position relative to this idea of what is sacred order and how does that relate to political ideologies on the right and the left. So the way that I see that we do this is we think in terms of what is the worldview that naturally arises from our philosophy, and especially from the four pillars of Dharma. Mm-hmm. When we think about austerity, purity, mercy, and truthfulness, and we think, okay, those are the core principles that drive our values, that then guide our ethics and moral decision making. Now, let's look at various political positions and government policies and such like that. How should we be responding, not according to my own personal conditioning? Mm-hmm. And this is really important, and something that I am in the process of doing an exercise to work through right now, to make sure that I am not guilty of bending our philosophy in the direction of my preferred political position just based on how the modes of material nature made me. There has to be intellectual honesty as well as spiritual honesty. Hmm. So intellectual honesty means I look to our system of epistemology, pramana, and make sure that whatever I think I believe passes the pramana test. So that's the first thing. The other thing is whatever I'm hearing from left, right, in the middle, does it pass the pramana test? Is it something worthy of reasonable belief? If so, I will give it serious consideration. If mm-hmm. not, and there's plenty of stuff that's not, I'm not going to give it the same consideration. I'm not going to give equal weight to everything. Mm-hmm. And this is something that a friend of mine pointed out in doing this particular exercise, that when we look at particular ways that Dharma shows up in liberal positions, conservative positions, other positions, somewhere on the three-dimensional spectrum, not everything gets the same value, doesn't get as many points when you try to add it up. Okay, so intellectual honesty, spiritual honesty, as we look at what's going on in the political world, what does Dharma have to say? What do the principles of Dharma have to say about any of these things? What does our worldview have to say about any of these things? And from this vision of looking at the political world, the socio-political, the economic world, to looking at all of these things through the lens of our worldview that comes from our philosophy, we can ascertain what is a policy position, what is a political position that is aligned with our philosophy. And I think that a political ideology is something we actually have. There's what I regard as a myth of neutrality. Because Gaudiya Vaishnavism is for everybody, and we have to accept everybody who comes. Well, you know, that's a double-edged sword. First of all, I don't think it's true. Krishna himself tells us in the Bhagavad Gita, who surrenders to him, who doesn't. Who's got a demonic mentality and is going to be like going off to the lowest life forms you can think of, and who is going to be on a trajectory towards him. So learning to recognize what's demonic and what's not based on the standards that Krishna has already given us, you know, that's part of looking at the world around us. Mm-hmm. And then we can say, well, we actually do have a political ideology based on our worldview. That's what worldviews do. They give rise to particular political ideologies. And I'll give an example. We regard temporary material coverings, or what is the word, that designations. We upadi. Regard, yes, temporary material designations as upadis, as artificial coverings on the spirit soul. So national identity, religious identity, ethnic identity, these are upadis. So when we find ourselves confronted with white Christian nationalism, we would naturally say, no, we're not buying that, because that's like an upadi trifecta. It's a triple upadi. And so it just stands to reason that we would not accept any form of nationalism that's connected to a religious identity, that's connected to an ethnic or racial identity. We would reject it. So we do have a position right there. And it is very easy, I think, for some people to mistake religious nationalists for allies. Even if they practice a different faith form, that they're thinking, oh, well, you know, they're worshiping God and they'll recognize that we're worshiping God in our own way. And no, actually, history tells us that people who are super sectarian in their religious beliefs regard other people's faith forms as a path to hell. And they happily expedite people who practice that faith. They expedite their journey to hell by burning them at the stake. These are dangerous people. Recognizing that danger, rather than deluding ourselves into thinking, well, these people, we have something in common with them because we worship God, or we have like a similar value or political position. I think that's a big mistake. Anyway, that's an example of what I mean about how we can actually arrive at understanding what our political ideology is while remaining faithful to our spiritual tradition and not choosing a partisan position simply in terms of right or left-wing politics.
Amen. Thanks for sharing that, especially in times where we live with there is so much polarization and political polarized people, and that extends everywhere else. And we reduce so much reductionism, I like to use that word, in not only in political terms, black and white, but that's, for me, it's a symptom of how reductionistic many times we are with our own selves. Like, I'm reading now a book about grieving, which is another subject matter, but I'll bring it that again back in the conversation, probably in connection to social protest and the role of grieving. But in that book, the author is making the point that most of us nowadays have been really reductionistic in our emotional landscape. And we have such an spectrum to experience so many emotions, but for the life we are living, the society we are living in, emotions have been like summarized to three or four, basically. I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm angry, us. Stop. Now, so my point is, and then again, it's like a black and white thing. So then we have the left and the right, black and white thing, and we project this basically fragmented, dualistic, and reductionistic view, which lacks nuance, lacks specificity, lacks personalism, basically. Mm-hmm. It's a basically very impersonal worldview, though nobody may say, I want to merge in Brahman. It's its own form of impersonalism. So I appreciate your words. And also, I was thinking, for us in our Bhakti school, that we are so much about love, and how much, as you say, love can be a tricky word, right? Because in the name of love, we can become too loose and too sentimental, and let's welcome everyone and everything is the same. It's all about love. But love, it's all about love, but love expresses itself in different shapes and ways. Again, unity and diversity. Love is the center of reality, but according to time, place, and circumstance, it will express itself in different ways. And one of those ways I'm thinking is discernment. That was the main word that came to me when I was hearing you. Like, we have to develop discernment. It doesn't mean that because we exist, we have discernment in place. So it's an attributed muscle that we need to train. Discern. It's like an ongoing exercise, an ongoing discipline on a daily basis. And as you were mentioning, it going to the pramana test, it's a hard one because it consumes your faculties in the good sense of the term. But you have to spend time with analyzing, contemplating, thinking deeply, and engaging with questions and staying with questions long enough till they blossom into proper answers, proper clarity. And again, not everyone wants to spend that much time with all that complicated stuff, unfortunately. I don't want to sound fatalistic here.
Well, but it's true.
I'm saying that to highlight how necessary that is, especially in a time where people is rushing and running and there's no time for anything and what to speak. Mm-hmm. Let's sit with the question till in. So yeah, I was thinking about those.
You know, you're calling to mind a statement that Srila Prabhupada made to his disciple Yogeshwar. Mm-hmm. He said to him, "What good is your big American brain if you do not use it in Krishna's service?" Mm-hmm. And one of the big challenges for our big brains, American or otherwise, is figuring out how to build the bridge between where we're at insofar as social order is concerned, and where we know we want to be, our conception of sacred order as social order. And, you know, the easy way out of this is to say, we need more Harinam, we need more book distribution, we need more, you know, the stuff that we always do. And
increase the numbers.
Yes. And you know, if we keep doing what we've always done, we'll get what we've always gotten. I mean, that's, you know, pretty much
no need to think about it. Just continue to do it and let the numbers grow.
Right. Or let Krishna take care of it. He'll make some arrangement. Well, you know, that's not our philosophy.
Yeah, wonderful way of being evasive to your responsibility.
Yes, exactly. It's spiritual bypassing on a social level.
Oh, yeah.
An excuse for disengagement, but we're being called on to get on the battlefield and take credit for what Krishna is doing through us, not what we're just lazily going off to tend to our own journey back to Godhead. And shirking our responsibility. You know, one of the things that came up while I was listening to you is the many different ways to understand impersonalism. By the book, impersonalism is Mayavadi philosophy and, you know, merging into the oneness of Brahman and all of the philosophical implications. But, you know, free market capitalism, neoliberal politics, that's economic impersonalism. That's political impersonalism. Impersonalism shows up in a wide variety of forms.
It's very easy to be impersonal, I can tell you.
Oh, yes. It can easily be our default position. And everything about our society, certainly here in America, pushes us in that direction. The media makes it very easy to become an impersonalist. So how many ways can we be radical personalists? How many fronts are there for us to inject personalism into in order to bring about the cultural re-spiritualization of society that is presumably our mission if we are taking up the mission of the Gaudiya Vaishnava expansion into a worldwide movement that actually has some impact.
Yeah, and I would think it, of course, asking ourselves, okay, where to inject this radical personalism, as you say, implies by itself first acknowledging all the areas where impersonalism is reigning around us and inside us. I'm doing a very comprehensive, assessment of the field, so to say, okay, which are all the varieties and expressions of impersonalism? Because only when I see impersonalism for what it is, I can address it with a better narrative or proposal, so to say, that we may call radical personalism or whatever. So, but again, for me, in part, something that gets in the way, and that's why I wrote a book called Radical Personalism, is I'm seeing that we do not have a very clear awareness and mindfulness of all the many ways that you can be impersonal and that we're actually being impersonal in the name of radical personalism, which makes the whole thing even more scandalous.
Yes, it's all the more frustrating to see.
Black says radical personalism, but you are many times we are not walking that talk. So that, of course, makes a lack of impact into whatever we are trying to bring into the world.
Yeah. When we forget that mercy, one of the principles of Dharma, has to manifest itself in a much broader bandwidth that includes caring about society, then we become social impersonalists while at the same time proclaiming the personal feature of the absolute truth as the highest feature. That, you know, we may proclaim the personal attribute of the spirit soul, that being made of the substance of Brahman does not erase our personal characteristics on a spiritual level, or as it manifests here in our incarnation in the material world. But, you know, that indifference to the well-being of, first of all, our own selves insofar as our embodied experience is concerned. You know, this can result in neglect of our health, neglect of our physical fitness. It can spiral into problems of mental health while we sort of dismiss them in the name of
self-forgetfulness in divine love.
Yes, exactly. And then, of course, on the social level, you know, in one of his purports in the Srimad Bhagavatam, speaking about King Vena, and I could go on and on about the parallels there, but in the interest of time, I'll only point out that Srila Prabhupada writes that the great sages were very anxious about the welfare of society.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a definition of, like, what are the characteristics of a great sage? A great sage is concerned for the welfare of society. If we aspire to be great sages, then that's going to be part of the territory. And he particularly says that it's not as if devotees or great sages are unconcerned with the people's welfare, both materially and spiritually. We're actually supposed to care about such things.
Yeah.
And yet, I hear very little conversation about that sort of thing, about what we should be doing insofar as expressing our concern for the welfare of society, other than just chant Hare Krishna and your life will be successful. You know, human beings are not good at nuance. You brought this up earlier, that, you know, thinking involves subtlety, involves, you know, digging into the weeds of a thing in order to ascertain truthfulness, in order to ascertain what exactly am I seeing, how is my power of discernment functioning? You know, is it under the influence of the mode of ignorance and I'm thinking that things that are not true really are true? Is it in the mode of passion? Am I at least experiencing my own discernment as being influenced by the mode of goodness or the mode of luminance? So from the standpoint of self-analysis, or the introspection of asking myself, how well is my discernment working? And what does scripture, our first source of authoritative knowledge, other than guru presenting us scripture, if Krishna tells us, okay, let scripture be your guide, then what does scripture tell me about the state of my capacity for critical thinking, otherwise known as discernment?
And I'm thinking over and over again, going back to the word discernment, that you compare with critical thinking. And I like to think how the Bhagavatam describes that the very first word, somehow we could say that heard in the universe is this word tapas that Brahma heard. And tapas literally means sometimes translated as austerity, and it's fine, but tapas means fire. And when Brahma hears fire, he doesn't take two branches and start to create fire. He closes his eyes and enters into this form of discernment. Mm-hmm. He becomes introspective. So somehow we can make that the case for the very first word that sets the whole creation in motion or puts the whole world in context is discernment. And I appreciate your connection between discernment and nuance, because that's when you find the in-between colors between black and white, all the 256 varieties of gray. The specificity, it's in discernment, and you have to spend time with that to really find the texture and the in-betweens of things. Mm-hmm. And again, without doing that, that's impersonalism, in my opinion, I will argue. So impersonalism, and I'm coming with definitions now, is indifference to nuance, basically. An indifference to engage with the nuanced nature of reality. And again, be reductionistic, is black and white, is this or that. Don't throw them into specificity, into the in-betweens. But that's how the whole universe begins. Tapas, fire, discernment, engagement with nuance. So I really appreciate, I mean, that those are connections that are coming now, but inspired by your words. And again, sometimes we may say, we should be compassionate, we should be merciful, and of course, all that is good. But I feel that sometimes for some people, it's more helpful, as Krishna does himself in the Gita, many times he resorts to what Christian theologians will call via negativa, to say what something is not, what something is. No? The soul cannot be burned, cannot be killed, it's not this. Eventually, he says something positive also about the soul. It's wonderful, but begins saying what it's not. So here I'm thinking for some people, it may work more. And for some practitioners and devotees, not even saying so much about you have to be compassionate and merciful, but don't be indifferent. I think it may create like some other type of impact, which of course it's another way of saying be concerned, right? Be kind, be loving, be present, be personalist. And I really appreciate your point that you made. Of course, we are talking at times on a social, political scale, but in one sense, it all begins at home. So being neglectful and indifferent to myself, impersonal in my relationship to myself, that naturally will play out then from the micro to the macro cosmos. Right? And that's, again, for me, that's a big conversation that I feel it's lacking, not only in our community, but at large, like how to have proper sense of self-love without being narcissistic, self-centered, but healthy self-love that translates into compassionate empathy and action in the world and our relationship with others. Yeah.
You cannot give what you do not have.
Basically.
So you have to have love for yourself, and you also have to make yourself available to experience love given to you from others.
Mm-hmm.
And once, not once, but you know, as your the well of your heart fills with love, well, then you can distribute that love to others. Mm-hmm. And the remarkable thing about that is as you distribute that love to others, your well gets even more full.
It's always reciprocal. Love,
yes.
It's not the one way street ever.
Never. It's like kind of the magic of love is that
multidirectional.
Including
ourselves. Because sometimes we can say, okay, you have to love, love God. Love the neighbor, love your pet, love your mom and dad, love yourself. Many times we have to begin there. Begin there knowing we are loved by God already. So that can bring some sense of self-acceptance instead of any time the shame and toxic guilt we feel, self-hatred we feel toward ourselves. Yeah.
It's one of the things that I will speak about in my classes or with my students is that if you are feeling low self-esteem, if you are down on yourself for whatever reason, remember, God thinks you are so cool He wants to hang out with you.
Thank you for that contemporary reading of ancient wisdom.
Yeah, and you know, if God thinks you're cool, then who are you to think you're not?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I say when with this verse 229 from the Gita, that Krishna speaks about the soul three times, uses the word acharya. Mm-hmm. Amazing. You are amazing. You're amazing. How much can you argue with him? No, that verse should be erased from the Gita, or it applies to everyone except for me. Somehow you have to accept it.
Yeah,
in a humbling way, because I'm not my own creation. So I happen to be amazing.
Yes, it is not like I made myself amazing.
Yeah, no reason
it's
to be proud.
It's my nature to be amazing, but no I can't reason. Really take credit for that.
Exactly.
And therefore, the acceptance of my own amazingness is not a function of ego. It's just an acceptance of reality.
And it's humbling if you do it correctly. It's actually humbling and moving.
Yes.
And you are invited to reciprocate, not just to say, I am amazing, I am amazing. Because you are amazing, everyone else is as well.
So. Yeah, it's not like I'm amazing and somebody's not.
That verse was written only for me. I know Krishna had me in mind exclusively in that verse of the Gita. No, it's
I had some very good advice recently from a friend of mine, a fellow yoga teacher. Mm-hmm. I was speaking to her about private clients, the private yoga clients. And she reminded me, as I revealed my own indifference to some people who I don't necessarily think of as being particularly interesting, mm-hmm. that actually everyone is amazing. And it's up to me to make teaching private yoga part of my spiritual practice. And part of it is to recognize, use my discernment to see what is it about this person that's amazing, because we're all amazing. And just the fact that we are is amazing in and of itself, but we're also all amazing in different ways because we are unique individuals. Mm-hmm. So this was also someone reflecting back something you said earlier about engaged Buddhism. This was also someone I had the pleasure of doing some comparison with. She's a follower of engaged Buddhism in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. Yeah. And so we were kind of side by side comparing Gaudiya Vaishnava engaged politics and engaged Buddhism engagement with the world. It was a really wonderful exercise in finding our commonalities. You know, they say if somebody agrees with you on 80% of things, then they are your ally. You don't focus on the 20% where you disagree. You know, you focus on the 80% where you do. Anyway, yes, recognizing, accepting that we ourselves are amazing, and then recognizing the amazingness of everyone else, that makes your whole life amazing.
Yeah, and for me, to be honest, that's very related to the socio-political dynamics we are talking about. Those for some people say, what do they have to do? But again, it all begins at home. And if I have a disjointed, fragmented, self-hatred-oriented sense of self, and you multiply that for millions and billions, then you have these bigger macro scenarios that we are speaking about in terms of social political dynamics. So, I mean, just as a compliment with certain action that, of course, may need to be taken in the world in response to certain things that are going on, but also as a, at least for me, sobering reminder about, okay, as Gandhi will say, be the change you want to see in the world. So If I hate myself today, still, how much can I really make a valuable change in the bigger scenario and speak of love and compassion if I'm not able to provide that to myself? So I think that's a very important preliminary but foundational step. And actually, that's what I'm writing about. I've just published the third one, but I'm almost finished with the fourth book on unconditional love and mm-hmm. how we are already loved and accepted at sin. And we should learn to apply that to ourselves, to others, and all the transformation that that can create. You have mentioned Hare Kirtan Buddhism for a moment, and I was recently watching this movie Kundum about the Dalai Lama, about his story of how he was not only born but eventually exiled from Tibet. He went to India. Intense movie and lots of grieving in one sense of losing and letting go and having to anyhow. And at one point, I remember one line, and I'd like to ask your thoughts on that. It was said, he said, I don't know if this is paraphrasing from the director or whatever, but nonviolence, we have been talking about compassion, kindness, sometimes a word for this is ahimsa or nonviolence. And this, of course, is so central to Buddhism. So he said nonviolence means cooperation when it's possible and resistance when it is not. Any thoughts?
Cooperation when it is possible and resistance when it is not.
Yeah, and you, of course, you can imagine he say that in certain contexts, in the situation he was seeing with the Chinese government and so on and so forth.
Right.
But it can apply to, I don't want to make it a hyper-universal pattern, but still it could be, of course, taking its unique shape in each given situation. But any thoughts?
I am currently running a course, which I will repeat in the future, called the Dharma Rebellion, Bhakti Yoga's vision for spiritual resistance.
Okay.
So this word right now, resistance.
Probably that will be the title of our conversation, just in case. So you can unpack the notion naturally.
Okay, yeah. So this notion of resistance, you know, that's a kind of a hot word right now. And it is certainly applicable insofar as resistance is a response, a nonviolent response to injustice and harm being done to others. Krishna Bhakta is very tolerant when it comes to enduring whatever the will of providence sends their way. We hear Brahma saying, whoever just patiently tolerates their karma while continuing to engage in devotional service, you know, their liberation has become their birthright. So, and this is true, or I accept this. However, the one thing that we cannot tolerate is the suffering of others. So when we see that resistance is called for in order to defend those who would be harmed by any given situation or administration, that's nonviolence. You know, when Arjuna is on the battlefield, he hears from Krishna how nonviolence, ahimsa, is one of the symptoms of knowledge. Yeah. And the whole Gita is Krishna's argument in favor of fighting. And this, of course, is the you know, ethical paradox of the Bhagavad Gita. You know, we have this idea that somehow or other, in this case, fighting is nonviolence because it's defensive. If you look at just war theory, a modern, relatively modern concept that has its roots in medieval Christianity. If you look at just war theory and you look at all the circumstances of the Battle of Kurukshetra, you find that it meets the criteria of just war theory. And so resistance as, or non-cooperation, advocacy for something different, direct action in the face of injustice, you know, all of the different strategies of social action that we can engage in when resistance is called for in one form or another. Those can all be aligned with the same kind of dharmic principles we spoke about earlier. And that's what the course is about, looking at the principles of Dharma and triangulating the position of bhakti yoga in the world of political ideologies, and then figuring out what is the right way to respond in the short term to our given situation, and what is the best way to start to build a bridge to a future that is aligned with sacred order rather than misaligned and producing the kind of social disorder that we're currently experiencing.
I'm thinking about the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, and I know you're familiar with it since you work a lot in the yoga community. And when he's speaking about the yamas and the niyamas, which basically is the beginning of yoga, interestingly enough, because for most people in the West, yoga is just asana, and asana is just how much? 15% of the whole equation and 8 steps of yoga. There is something to be done before asana, and there are a lot to be done after that. So not to downplay asana in itself. So he starts with yama niyama, and he begins with ahimsa, and then comes satyam, right? So it's interesting how the immediacy and the connection between these two, like, okay, non-violence, which as we are just describing, can mean resistance or non-cooperation at times, and satyam, which means truth. So somehow my point with this is, as long as it's in the service of truth, it can take so many shapes, this form of, this idea of ahimsa or non-violence. It can be active, it can be passive, it can be this, it can be that, but the context is, it has to be in the service of truth. And again, that's the one thing that never changes, the Veda side, and the Abheda is, it may take any and every form according to the need of the moment, right? And again, that going back requires discernment. Or spending time to, okay, what's the best way to honor truth in this unique given situation, which is different from the one 5 minutes ago. So it's very engaging internally, really. It's a form of meditation in its own way. It's not only outer activism. Ideally, there is outer activism, but it has to be complemented with a form of inner contemplation or discernment. That's why I appreciate one of my main mentors, in this case, connected with the Franciscan tradition, Father Richard Rohr. He has his center called Center for Action and Contemplation. And he will say the most important word in that name is "and."
Yeah, that's very wise.
Yeah,
these two things have to go together, just as nonviolence and truthfulness. You know, in Patanjali's system, nonviolence comes first, and truthfulness in service to nonviolence is how they work together. And at least in Patanjali's yoga system, this is the first and foremost universal, no exceptions, you always got to do this rule. And in modern yoga, in his book Light on Yoga, BKS Iyengar says that asana without the yamas and niyamas is just calisthenics. It loses its power or its meaning as yoga. And in our tradition, truthfulness is the foundation of Dharma. You know, it's the last leg. And nonviolence is... it goes the other way around. Nonviolence in the service of truthfulness is kind of how the order is changed a little bit. But either way, they go hand in hand. You have to have nonviolence and truthfulness. They are, you know, interdependent in the same way that the sun and the sunshine are interdependent. The sun is not the sun without the shine, and the shine doesn't happen without the sun. So thinking about resistance also is nonviolence, is ahimsa, when it is engaged in the service of truthfulness. And I can certainly very easily see how the absence of truth, non-factuality, would be a part of what the Dalai Lama himself has to push back against, in so far as the interference of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is concerned, that he has to confront.
And of course, this may require a whole different, entire different podcast, and that may be a good chance to continue my conversation with you. We live in postmodern times where people speak about post-truth, when basically there's this hyper-subjective notion where you make your own truth. There is no actual, again, dharma or sacred order or inherent truthfulness to anything. So that's another layer that we have to engage in conversation with when we bring all these topics, because that makes the whole thing way more challenging and complex. But we need to acknowledge that's there with a very pervasive influence, and we had to address that as well. As
part it's something that's a big challenge in the yoga community, which tends to default to a kind of postmodern personal truth point of view, which is not accepted in the yoga tradition. The idea that everyone's personal truth is as valid as anybody else's personal truth, and the problems of my personal truth conflicts with your personal truth, and the whole issue of factuality and the purpose of lies, purposeful lies, as explained by Hannah Arendt in her books about fascism and totalitarianism. And anyway, if that means we have to come back and have another conversation, well, I would be delighted.
Just throwing that there into the ether to see what's the response. So, I trust that will happen for sure. This or any other topic. So I was recently, I think it was one of the lectures you gave, you shared with me some material also you've written, whether it was one or the other, but one of those you mentioned, very nice line that I was moved in connection to what we are talking about. You say something like, sorry if I'm quoting you wrongly, but joyfulness is a form of resistance. So we are talking about resisting, non-cooperation, and so on. Now we bring joyfulness into the picture. So can you share a few thoughts about this tension? Because sometimes resistance is also related to the notion of anger, for example. People is angry. There is a lot of anger in this world, and I'm not, just to clarify, I'm not against being angry. I mean, there is a place for anger, because sometimes, again, in spiritual communities, we may repress or suppress anger and say, that's a bad emotion. You are not supposed to feel that. If you feel that, that's a symptom that you are still not on the ideal level. You should be feeling who knows what. And I will say that, as I try to make the point in radical personalism, that there are no bad emotions. Emotions are. There are bad things we do with emotions.
Right.
But emotions are, and they need to be acknowledged and, of course, dealt with in the healthiest possible way. So, again, resistance and activism many times is tied with anger. There is a place for anger. There is a place for, and many times behind anger, and we will go there maybe in a minute, there is sadness. But now let's bring for a moment joy. So how you say joyfulness is a form of resistance. Resistance sometimes is tied with anger. So how to hold anger and joy together in sacred activism?
That's a great question. Anger is a double-edged sword. You know, here on the one hand, Krishna speaks about anger as one of the three gates to hell. And therefore we think, again, spiritual bypassing. I will not be angry no matter what, even when I have every good reason to be angry. But then after Arjuna accepts everything Krishna has told him and he's ready to fight, they got out on the battlefield, and Krishna reminds Arjuna what a bunch of rotten scoundrels the Kauravas were, just to get him angry enough to fight with...
You cannot fight without being angry, right?
No, you cannot fight without being angry. So, you know, there's a difference between the anger you manifest for the sake of fighting the good fight. That is justifiable anger. You're fighting for a good reason. So there's that anger. And then there's the anger that just consumes you into a whirlpool of incapacitation.
Yeah, resentment and bitterness and cynicism.
Right. And that is why joyfulness is resistance, is cultivating, like, you know, if you let the people who are making you angry live rent-free 24/7 in your head, you're just going to be angry, and that anger is going to lead to sadness, and that sadness is going to be all consuming, and then you'll feel like you can't do anything. And that's exactly the point. When someone with power does something to make you so angry and so sad and so mentally discombobulated that you don't know what to do and you think you can't do anything, they've won.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a song by a band called Chumbawamba called Laughter in a Time of War. It's a wonderful song about the importance of maintaining one's inner joy and celebrating life, even when you are under threat, even when you feel like the world is falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely essential for our own self-empowerment to cultivate joy. And in our tradition, our practices are meant to awaken our natural spiritual joyfulness, which is a joyfulness that is not dependent on external conditions.
Mm.
And to the extent that we are able to cultivate and manifest that joy, to that extent, we will be able to generate the justifiable anger that we're in control of, rather than the kind of anger that controls us, in order to effectively engage in resistance in whatever form resistance has to take under what and whatever circumstances call for that resistance.
Hmm. Thank you for bringing that. And I go back to the ideas, center for action and contemplation, like having an inner life, cultivating gratitude. And even when, especially in the world we are living today, where we are bombarded, I mean, not only literally bombarded in some places, but bombarded with information and so many things happening in so many places at the same time. Never before we were aware of every detail around the globe. So that's a lot of information to process, and we can really be overwhelmed, paralyzed, too angry, too everything. So, and we were talking about that when my recent visit to DC. I think I gave one lecture on spiritual activism or something to that effect, and many of the conversations revolve around that. We were missing you in that one. Mm. But anyhow, next one.
Yes.
But we were talking about, and that was kind of the many a thread that came over and over again. Okay, how to remain aware of the suffering and tragedies in the world, and at the same time don't basically go crazy and do something about it, because there's so much to do about so many things, that what to choose, what to do, and how to do that properly. Because we were thinking, if you just zoom in in a particular situation of injustice, abuse, suffering, and continue to zoom in, I mean, it's mad. You go crazy. It's overwhelming. You got paralyzed. So it's not about, okay, let's run away from that and forget that exists, but keep that at a certain point where I can also see things. I can also see beauty. I can also see great things to be grateful for, apart from all the tragedy and all the loss and all the things to cry for or to be angry at. So many other, so to, again, nuanced, putting everything on the scale, not sacrificing one at the cost of the other, that sometimes can happen in the name of well-intentioned activism. We end up becoming too angry, too resentful, too zooming in one direction. And many times become cynics, and everything becomes very dark. And we don't want the other extreme to be just naive, right? Like, now beauty and love and God, and let's join hands together.
Rainbows and unicorns everywhere.
Yeah, and it's so easy. I read an author some time ago that they said those who are the most naive, when they get disillusioned, generally are the ones who jump from the other to the other extreme of the spectrum and become the worst cynics.
Yes.
So how to keep the middle path right in place, yeah, and hold balance for that.
And, yeah, you know, this also has a social application. I'm personally very, very fortunate, and I hope I maintain an appropriate sense of gratitude for how fortunate I am. When I need to be reminded of how beautiful and amazing the world is, I have a wonderful view of the sky from my apartment. And I take a few moments to look at the sky. Sometimes I will see the moon early in the morning or rising early in the evening. And I will just look at the sky and I will just think of the world as a site-specific art installation that is constantly changing and completely beautiful and amazing and becoming at every moment. And, you know, this is a wonderful, inspiring thing for me. But somebody who just lost their SNAP benefits and now doesn't have an opportunity to get food, and they live in a food desert, and they can't provide for their family, or someone who just lost their healthcare benefits, their insurance coverage, and now there's no way that they can afford what they need to cover whatever ails them, plus their rent, plus their groceries, or do any. You know, people like that don't have the leisure time to lead a contemplative life, mm-hmm, because the situation that they're in has become so all-consuming just for the basic of survival. And this was pointed out recently also. Somebody brought this up in conversation that, you know, our conditioning in the West is based on this pyramid of basic needs first, self-actualization last at the top of the pyramid, mm-hmm, as opposed to what we find in indigenous cultures here in America that say self-actualization first, and then on the basis of self-actualization, that's how you meet your basic needs. And that's actually a lot more similar to, I think, our philosophy, that the project of self-actualization or self-realization, however you would want to put it, is the driving force behind how we go about meeting our basic needs and the driving force behind how we want to structure society in order for everyone's needs to be met so that, mm-hmm, everyone is peaceful, everyone is happy, everyone has what they need so they don't have to think about getting what they need and they can think more about their inner lives. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah,
this action and contemplation is good for us. We need to have both of those things, and we want to be able to bring both of those opportunities to others, and, mm-hmm, you know, especially those who are being disadvantaged by a system that is designed to keep everybody too busy to engage in either critical thinking or spiritual introspection.
Yeah, there's a lot there, and we need another podcast to analyze Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs according to the lens of our tradition and other traditions. So second podcast with Hari Kirtan, third one already. Yeah, and I appreciate your point of your situation of being very fortunate, that if you want to use privileged and recently, and of course, at the same time, acknowledging the lackings or situations of other people. Recently, I heard this beautiful, interesting quote that someone told me, the only response to privilege is absolute integrity.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, this is why, you know, I'm the middle-aged straight white guy. I need to be on the front lines. I don't have anything to lose compared, mm-hmm, to so many others who are at risk in the current, yeah, situation. So figuratively or literally, I have a moral responsibility to be out front, insofar as resistance is concerned. Mm. And the people who are at risk, they should be behind me. I should be their shield.
Yeah, yeah. Before we wrap up, we have a few more minutes, Hari Kirtan. I'd like to ask, mm-hmm, and I briefly mentioned that, but a few more elaborations on that. We're talking about rebellion and activism and the role of joy and anger. I'd like to touch for a moment, and again, this requires another separate podcast, that we have another one, the notion of grief, because I personally, and many of my teachers also taught me that, that many times when we see someone angry, behind anger, there is some type of sadness. I mean, we are angry because we care for something that is breaking our hearts. Let's put it that way. So I finished reading one book from one author called Francis Weller called The Wild Edge of Sorrow. And he speaks about, related to many ancient native traditions and other spiritual schools, and the role of grieving in the ancient villages and in the communities as a healing practice. And there's so much to grieve about, not only individually, what's happening in our life, what's happening in our extended village, in the world at large, extended grief that was passed on to us by our ancestors, that they have not grieved, different dimensions of grieving. And he will refer as grieving as soul activism, interestingly, because many times we think of activism in certain, again, reductionistic way. So he refers to grieving as soul activism. So I'd just like to bring that to the table and hear your thoughts on the role of grieving in the context of activism or dharma rebellion, as you have presented that.
Yeah, thank you. Krishna begins his teaching in the Bhagavad Gita by telling Arjuna, you're grieving for what is unworthy of grief. And then at the end, our philosophical conclusion, his last instruction is Masuchaha, which is often translated as do not fear, but it can also be understood as you have no reason to grieve. So it's so re-emphasizing that point. And then the battle is fought and so many people die. And then what does Krishna do? He helps the Pandavas grieve. So this idea of no grief is not an eternal, universal, transcontextual teaching. It's specific to Arjuna's situation. Now is not the time to grieve. Later, grief.
Yeah, do not grieve is not the same as now is not the time to grieve.
Yes, but it's very much a contextual instruction. So I think oftentimes we miss this, some of the instructions that Krishna gives are not just eternal, transcontextual. They're specific. Otherwise, he would say, after the battle, like, oh, yeah, everyone's dead. So what? Whatever. No, that's not what happens at all. So there is a place for grief. And, in terms of responding to socio-political situations, I was teaching yoga classes in 2016, and I live in Washington, D.C., a super liberal place. Like, literally 98% of the people here did not vote for Donald Trump. Nobody who lives here that isn't part of the government now is into him. And so when he won the election in 2016, my yoga classes became trauma wards. People were freaked out. They were afraid. They were grieving.
Yeah.
And then again, now, with the re-election, that grief comes back. It's grief for the end of the American ideal as we have known it during the course of our entire lives.
Yeah, acknowledging a type of loss.
Yes, exactly. And you have to do that.
Yeah.
There are five stages of grief. I think they are denial, anger, negotiating, then grieving, and then finally acceptance. And you have to let yourself go through all of those stages. And so from the standpoint of a changing political situation where, one side may be celebrating and another side is thinking this means the end of our government as we have always known it. Before you can accept the situation and begin the hard work of building something new out of the ashes of whatever is being dismantled. You have to go through those stages, and that's healthy and normal.
Yeah.
And it is the responsibility of spiritual leaders to, first of all, allow themselves to go through that process.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, act as a companion to help others go through that process. To just, I mean, you know, sometimes you just have to help somebody cry.
Of course.
And then
don't be tempted to give advice and tell them what to do.
Yeah.
Shut up and be present unconditionally and listen.
Yes, exactly. You know, which is difficult for men, I think, because we always default to like, oh, you got a problem? Oh, sure, I'll help you fix that.
Yeah, fixer, rescuer, archetype, superhero.
Right, exactly. So we have to resist that. Men in particular have to resist the temptation to immediately go about fixing the problem and wait for the right time.
Yeah.
To think about now what is going to come next. You just have to develop that patience and compassion for meeting everyone where they are, and compassion for yourself to let you go through that process yourself.
Waiting sometimes is staying with your own pain also, and
staying
with the pain enough so it teaches you the lesson that it wants to deliver, actually.
You know, the same yoga teacher that I was speaking with about private classes, you know, she asked me in terms of how I would deal with people. She said, you know, have you ever had any injuries? And I've been really, really lucky in that respect. I have not had any major injuries, whereas a lot of yoga teachers, they start teaching yoga as a result of having practiced yoga to recover from an injury. So in a sense, I've been very lucky, but I have a disadvantage in so far as being able to relate to people's injuries.
Hmm.
Anyway, just that's kind of a little tangential, but the idea, yes, is that sitting with pain, our own and other people's, for an appropriate amount of time.
Of course.
Before we start, you know, recognizing, okay, now I am ready to move on. Now they are ready to move forward. And then thinking about, okay, how to build something new, how to create something in the cycle of creation, maintenance, and destruction.
Yeah, and staying enough time with pain with yourself, that can create so much bonding with others, because at the end of the day, pain is something so universal that we all go through.
Yes.
It's paradoxical how many times pain is the thing we isolate the most in our lives, and we isolate ourselves the most in that pain, and we lose sight of how common and universal is this pattern. If we're able to share that pain with others, we realize, wow, that creates so much bonding and community and so much more.
It's a very good exercise to go through, to ask yourself, if you see somebody else in pain, you can ask yourself, when have I experienced something similar? It may not be a one-to-one comparison. It may be apples to peaches, but it's still fruit.
Yeah.
And in this way, we can help to develop our empathy, you know, to exercise the empathy muscle.
Still is a fruit, and there is a fruit in that waiting for us, for sure. Yeah. Hare Krishna, bro, you have 5 more minutes to share with me?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I generally am finishing for the last months my conversation with something I call Ushnena Samapayat. In our tradition, we have Madhurena Samapayat. Let's end with something sweet. I changed that for Ushnena Samapayat. Let's end with something spicy. And I know you will be ready for that, which is the premise is short questions, honest answers, no overthinking, and just your gut truth coming. And
oh, now I'm in trouble. Okay.
No, I trust you will do perfect.
All right,
just fasten your signal just in case.
Okay.
So first one, tell me a line from the Shastra that strikes you politically today.
A line from
Shastra.
It can
be some words from Prabhupada or from the teachers, from scripture.
A line from Shastra would be thus out of compassion, they began to talk among themselves, for they themselves were performers of sacrifice. This is the Brahmanas thinking about what to do about King Vena.
Okay, thank you. A term in our Gaudiya Vaishnava culture that you think needs to evolve or be retired altogether?
Preaching.
I put my name in that one also. A personal moment when activism cracked your heart open.
When activism cracked my heart open, or when an event cracked my heart open to encourage me to engage in activism?
Yeah, let's put it that way.
On Long Island, when I was growing up, there was a newspaper called Newsday. It may still be in existence. And it ran a photograph of a Viet Cong, I wouldn't even say soldier because he was in civilian dress, being executed by some South Vietnamese commander, or it, but also somebody who was not in military garb. Mm-hmm. So, and it was quite a shocking photo. I was probably 10 or 11 years old at the time. I was in fourth grade, however old that is. And the next assignment that I got in social studies, I don't remember what exactly the assignment was, but it resulted in my writing a anti-Vietnam War essay.
Thank you. Number four, which is a critique that you have received that actually helped you?
That I am prone to arrogance. So I am trying to be aware of that tendency and not let it show up.
Thanks for sharing that with us. What truth gets you in the most trouble?
What
truth gets truth. You? Yeah, gets you in the most trouble.
I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly prone to getting in trouble, but I'm not sure which truth. I don't know. I'm going to have to get back to you on that. It's a really interesting question.
Yeah, I trust you will spend your time with that question after the conversation.
I will.
That's part of the intention of this. Some of them may be, and I don't know, and I will think about it. And
that's yeah, one. That's Thank one. You.
Which is one contemporary issue in our that our Vaishnav community avoids but shouldn't. In general, of course.
In America, it's Christian nationalism.
Okay. Which is one sacred discomfort that you are learning to sit with?
A sacred discomfort?
Yeah.
Paramatma. The idea that Krishna sees everything I see, hears everything I hear.
Okay.
No secrets.
That's a good reply. I think transparency with omniscience in between.
Yeah, getting comfortable with Paramatma.
What does Hare Kirtan whisper to Hare Kirtan when it all feels too much?
You have a duty to keep going.
Two more. What will someone like Bhaktivinoda Thakur write about today if he had a Substack account?
That's a really interesting question. I would ask ChatGPT to answer that question because I would like to know myself. I think he would write, the first thing that comes to mind is he would write about the injustice of the distribution of wealth and how that undermines spiritual progress for society.
Thank you. Final one. If you could whisper one sentence into the heart of every spiritual activist, what will it be?
It's going to be all right.
So before we officially conclude, Hari Kirtan Prabhu, I want to give you the last word. Any parting reflection, encouragement, whatever you may like to leave us with today?
I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity to have this conversation with you. I think it's been a long time coming, and I am so happy to have the opportunity to speak about these topics with a devotee who finds value in them, and with whom I feel like I share a lot of the same interests and sense of what is important for our personal spiritual lives and for the spiritual upliftment of people in general. So thank you very much for inviting me to have this conversation with you. This is my idea of a good time. I could occupy all of your time with this kind of conversation. So I consider this a wonderful opportunity, and I'm very grateful for it.
Thank you. Thank you. It's reciprocal. And as Krishna De Gita say, we could be doing this forever. And that's our excitement, that we have eternity on our side. And that's the prospect, like to internally engage in this nourishing exchange. So thank you so much. And before I forget, those who would like to know more about Hari Kirtan Prabhu and his courses and activities, you can visit his website, which I'm sharing here. It's Hari, Hari-Kirtan, KIRTANA.com. HariKirtan.com with a hyphen between Hari and Kirtan.
So thank you.
Thank you so much, Hari Kirtan Prabhu.
Thank you, Maharaj.
My pleasure.